Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 13, Text Number 28. Ityē tadātmanā svartam santam vismṛtyavai pumān vichitram asati dvaite gauram apnoti samśmṛtim. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Śrīla Prabhupāda. In this way, the conditioned soul, living within the body, forgets his self-interest because he identifies himself with the body. Because the body is material, his natural tendency is to be attracted by varieties of the material world. Thus, the living entity suffers the miseries of material existence. Purport. Everyone is trying to be happy because, as explained in the previous verse, sukham asyatmano rupam sarve ho paratis tanu. When the living entity is in his original spiritual form, he is happy by nature. There is no question of miseries for the spiritual being. As Krishna is always happy, the living entities, who are his parts and parcels, are also happy by nature. But because of being put within this material world and forgetting their eternal relationship with Krishna, they have forgotten their real nature. Because every one of us is part of Krishna, we have a very affectionate relationship with him. But because we have forgotten our identities and are considering the body to be the self, we are afflicted by all the troubles of birth, death, old age, and disease. This misconception in materialistic life continues unless and until one comes to understand his relationship with Krishna. The happiness sought by the conditioned soul is certainly only illusion, as explained in the next verse. Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishnapastaya. Hypothetical situation. Okay, you have a friend. This is a friend that you've had for like many, many years, very good friend, you know, childhood friend, and you've known him all your life. And this friend of yours is, your assessment of this is a very nice person. Now, you've known him for many, many years, okay? And this person is by nature, he's very kind, he's very gentle, he's very responsible, you know, all good qualities. This person, this friend of yours, has all good qualities. You've observed it over a prolonged period of time, okay? And so one day, your friend invites you to his home for dinner. So you go there, and when you arrive at his home, you hear crying. And it's coming from one of the bedrooms. And so you say to your friend, "Hey, what's up with that?" And the friend goes, "Oh, that's a junior. That's my son. He's getting a bit of time out." Time out, to an American expression, means like a punishment, you know, and a kid's misbehave. So immediately, you know, because you know your friend, you'll give your friend the benefit of the doubt. You'll come to the conclusion, okay, well, what must be happening here is that's my friend's son. He's misbehaved, and he's being punished as a result. And that's why he's crying, and that's why, you know, he's suffering. You wouldn't come to the conclusion, oh, wow, my friend's sadistic. He's deliberately inflicting, you know, he's deliberately trying to make this innocent child of his suffer. No, because you know your friend. You know that he wouldn't operate like that. He wouldn't do like that. See? So in the same way, and this is an analogy, right? We are the spiritual children of Krishna. You know? Prabhupada uses the phrase here, part and parcel. But and elsewhere, he actually uses that expression too, where in the Bhagavad Gita, there's that verse where Krishna says, "I am the seed-giving father of all living entities." And also in the 15th chapter, he says, "Mamai vamso jiva loke, jiva bhuta sanatana." You know, these living entities are my eternal fragmental parts and parcels. See? So in other words, really, we actually are we're the spiritual offspring of Krishna. the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I can't remember which Vedic literature it comes from, but Prabhupada would often quote, Eko Bahu Sham, that Krishna is one, and he expands himself as the living entities. Those, we're actually, we're spiritual expansions of Krishna. Technically, we're referred to as Vibhinamsa. See? So, you know, in that sense, sort of like a, you know, a nice way you could put it is we're Krishna's spiritual offspring. We're Krishna's spiritual children. Okay? So, do you think that Krishna is going to go to all the trouble of bringing us into existence? Because he, of course, it's not trouble for Krishna. I mean, but he's expanding as us. You think it's just for the purpose of seeing us suffer? Does that make any sense? Yeah? I mean, you know, all throughout the world, people have who believe in God, their conception of God is that he's, you know, all, aside from being all-powerful and all-knowing, he's all-loving. He's all good. He's all merciful. So is a God who is all good, all loving, and all merciful going to bring living entities into existence for the express purpose of seeing them suffer? No. Doesn't, you know, of course not. It'd be a contradiction in definition there. It doesn't make any sense. But the point is, but yet we could see that there is a lot of suffering in this world. Right? It's obvious. Tons of suffering in this world, and not just in human society, but, you know, I mean, in all the different species of life, there's a lot of suffering. And so how do we understand this? How do we understand it? In the same way, just, you know, that the living entities, you know, are the spiritual children of Krishna and all the different species of life, but due to misbehavior, you know, due to being misbehaved, in other words, you know, the way Prabhupada usually would express that is misuse of free will, right? We're being punished. We're being punished. And as Prabhupada puts it here in this purport, he says that punishment takes the form of being put. He uses that word, put. Put means, it says, put within this material world. That means, you know, like it or not, boom, we've been put here. As we actually, our real position is due to our offense. Actually, well, I'll back up a teeny bit. Prabhupada says, and forgetting their eternal relationship with Krishna. He sort of puts those two side by side, that we've been put within this material world and we forgot our, we're forgetting our eternal relationship with Krishna. So, you know, maybe we didn't forget our eternal relationship with Krishna until we came here to this material world, but certainly while we were still there in the spiritual world, you know, we did something that warranted our coming here. And actually, Prabhupada states that in the third canto, I can't remember exactly the text and, you know, the chapter text in Purport, where he says, due to the living entity's offense in his eternal relationship with Krishna, he comes here to, he's put into material existence. So as we committed an offense, you know, in the, when we were in the spiritual world and our, you know, relating in our relationship with Krishna, and as a result, we have to come here to this material world. But it's Krishna's desire. So in other words, the suffering that we're seeing, you know, the in all the different, you know, the conditioned souls in all the different species of life, that's as a result of our own mistake. No, it's not Krishna's fault. It's not Krishna's fault that all the living entities in this material world are suffering like anything. It's due to misuse of our own free will. Krishna's desire is actually that we enjoy with him eternally in the spiritual world. And actually, and here's the good part, you know, because this is an expression in American, every cloud has a silver lining. So that's actually true, you know, about material life. We have to understand material life in this way, that whatever condition of life you see anybody in, human being or any other species of life, even if it's like apparently one of intense suffering, that's been arranged by Krishna so that that living entity can learn a lesson, can learn what it needs to learn so that it can, you know, get back on the right track and progress towards, you know, reestablishing its relationship in pure devotional service with Krishna. It's actually a feature of Krishna's mercy. And that's, you know, that's kind of hard to swallow at the first bite, but that's actually what's going on. Everything that we see, every you know, human being experiencing that might appear to be, you know, not so good, and what to speak of the lowest species of life, it's actually a feature of Krishna's mercy. It's actually Krishna attempting to help that living entity get back on the right track. But it's hard for us to understand in our conditioned life. Just like, you know, to give an example, say I you know, you're walking and I know you're trying to get to the Prashalam Hall, and I say, hey, stop, you know, and you go, well, what's going on? I'm, you know, why are you stopping me? I'm trying to get to the Prashalam Hall. You know, can't you see I'm in, you know, I'm, you know, we're going there because we want to take Prashalam and be happy. So you would see, well, what's the interference here? Why are you interfering? I'm, you know, because like, you know, you're going the wrong way. You're a new person here. You don't know. You're going the wrong way. I'm stopping you because you're going the wrong way. If you keep going that way, you're going to walk right off the property and be in a bad neighborhood or something like that. So here, go this way. So that's basically what Krishna is doing. You see, the living entities are trying to become happy. And by all this suffering and material existence, Krishna is saying, stop. You see, you're going the wrong way. I know Krishna understands what's going on. You know. Okay, he understands the living entities are trying to be happy. He's not like, you know, trying to be a bad guy and just frustrate our enjoyment. No, Krishna knows that's not the way to go about becoming happy. Stop. Don't do it like that. It's not going to work. You see? But in our ignorance, in our illusion, we think, well, what's going on here? You know, I'm trying to become happy. And Krishna's stopping me. You know, people think, you know, how could the old problem of evil, you know, how could there be a God who's all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-loving, and all-good, and all-merciful when there's so much suffering in the world? It goes back to that because people don't understand that, you know, this point here, that we're off the track. We're going off track. And basically what's happening is Krishna's trying to, you know, stop us and get us back on track. And because we don't understand that, we think that, oh, God if there is a God, he must not be a very good God. Because look what's going on here. You know, myself, including everybody else, including myself, is, you know, suffering to one degree or another. He can't be a very good God, or there must not be a God. But this is, you know, the incorrect understanding. There is a God, it's Krishna. And as I said, everything that's happening is just, it's a feature of his mercy. He's trying to help the living entities learn what they need to learn so they can, you know, sort of get back and start making progress towards pure devotional service. Now, somebody might ask, well, you know, what about, okay, I can understand that point, you know, but what about devotees? You know, sometimes we see that, you know, devotees, they're also suffering. I mean, you know, devotees have got the right idea. They've understood that, you know, that they can't become happy in materialistic life, but that they have to, you know, give up that material conception and, act within the spiritual conception of that we're spirit soul, you know, we're eternal servants of Krishna, we have to engage favorably in devotional service, and they're doing that, and as we've understood, theoretically, what our situation is, and we're actually even acting upon that, we're putting it into practice in our life, and still we could see that, you know, even among devotees, there is suffering in the lives of devotees, you know, sometimes. And so how do we understand that? Well, a couple things. One point is that, I'll try to answer that question by giving an example. Any devotees here memorize verses? Sloka memorization? Raise your hand if you do some sloka memorization. Probably everybody's done a bit. If you're not raising your hand, I know it's because you're just shy or something like that. But everybody's, I'm sure, memorized a few shlokas, and some devotees probably have that as regular practice. Okay. So just let me ask you this question. Say you memorize a shloka today, okay? And you don't repeat it tomorrow. You wait 1 week before you try to, remember it again, before you try to quote it to a friend or something like that. Are you going to be able to pull it off, you think? You memorize it today, and you just forget all about it for 1 week. In 1 week's time, you're going to be able to just, you know, rattle that shloka off like you did when you had it down that, you know, today? Most likely not, unless you're got a pretty extraordinary memory. I know I wouldn't be able to, you know. If I memorize a shloka today and I want to keep it with me, I got to, you know, say it to a couple other people today. You know, I got to recite it to my wife, a couple of devotees I bump into. I got to use it in a class the first chance I get. I got to use it when I'm, you know, out on the street, maybe trying to distribute a book to someone else. The more you use it, the more it becomes, the more you becomes part of you. In other words, repetition solidifies the learning process. That's the point. Repetition solidifies the learning process. So just like, you know, and then eventually what happens is it becomes, you know it by heart. You know that expression? You know it by heart. It becomes second nature. Like there's certain verses, I used to do, you know, a fair amount of shloka memorization. And unfortunately, I could say there's a lot of verses that I learned and I knew, but I couldn't remember them for the life of me now. But then there's other verses that I know are going to, you know, they just stick with me. I've got them. They're there. I've known by heart, like man mana bhava mad bhakto, you know, some basic ones, you know. Why? Because I've heard Prabhupada say them so much. I've heard other devotees quote them so much. I myself have quoted them, and you know, in the process of giving classes and this and that. Just they're there. They're part of me now. That's part of me now. That's like vigyan. Vigyan in the sense that I think I'll remember those till the moment I have to give up this body. So in the same way, the point being that Krishna has even the devotees, we see the suffering in the life of the devotees, getting back to the question, and that's because Krishna really wants us to learn, really thoroughly, you know, that there is no happiness here in this material world, that the happiness lies in, you know, progressing in pure devotional service. He really wants us to know that thoroughly, not just as gyan, but Krishna wants us to come to the platform of vigyan. In other words, in the sense, Krishna wants us to know that by heart, you know, literally, you know, in the full sense of that expression. He wants us to know that by heart, that there is really no happiness to be found here in the pursuit of material sense gratification, and that the real happiness is in engaging in pure devotional service. And that's why we see that there's, you know, suffering even in the lives of devotees, because Krishna is the best teacher, and he's really we're his students, and he's really trying to drive that point home, so to speak. Now let's take it one level further, okay? How come sometimes we see that, you know, some devotees say, okay, Krishna's, we can understand that's what Krishna is doing. He's trying to really get us so the devotees know that by heart. But we see sometimes some devotees leave the body in the process. You know, sometimes we see some devotees, they're very sincere devotees. You know, they're doing everything. Sometimes they're even exemplary devotees. They're surrendering in every different which way, and they're, as I said, they're our role models and exemplars and, you know, inspirations. And we see that somehow in their lives the suffering doesn't let up, and it actually gets worse, and to the point where they, at some point, leave their body. How do we understand that? You know, you think that okay, at some point Krishna would let up and let that devotee enjoy the fruits of his studying and trying to of all his endeavors. But that's another feature of Krishna's special mercy, that those devotees are just being taken home back to Godhead. See? In other words, they've learned everything they have to learn, and Krishna, rather than just have them stick around here and enjoy the fruits of their pure devotional service here in this lifetime and in this earthly plane, which he could do, and probably he does do sometimes, he's just decided to remove them and move them on to their next assignment, you know, that which is going back to Godhead perhaps, or joining up with Prabhupada wherever he is now and assisting Prabhupada further in his preaching thing. And that's what I think is going on there. I remember once I was in Los Angeles, and His Holiness, the late Sridhar Maharaj, was there, and what was the disease he had again? Hepatitis, yeah, Hep C, as he used to say, Hep C. So he was saying one day, I can't remember if it was in a class or if he was just saying it as we were talking or what, but he was kind of making the point. He was just reflecting. He was saying, man, you know, what's going on? You know, he was talking to Krishna, you know, and candidly, he was going, Krishna, please let me, you know, I'm all trained up. Why should I have to leave the body now? You know, he felt like, you know, after so many years of, you know, being a sannyas and being a preacher, he just felt like, well, you know, I mean, I just, now I'm just confident that I know my service. I know what I'm supposed to be doing. I know how to preach and how to stay sannyas and like that. And I'm just, you know, I'm doing it. So why now? You know, why not? So, and of course, he left it as a rhetorical question, but it didn't occur to me then, but it just occurred to me this morning as I was kind of reflecting on, you know, this class, what I was going to say, that I should have said to him, you know, Maharaj, that means you're going back to Godhead. Because just logically, In other words, why would Krishna remove him from the scene as he himself said, just when he's all trained up? You know, it wouldn't make any sense unless he was going back to Godhead, unless he was finished with material existence. Because if he's got to come back here, that means he's got to take birth again. He's got to go through the whole thing of growing up. You know, he's got to be, you know, in a material body with a family and growing up and being a kid again and being a youth again. And, you know, he got to go through the whole thing again until he comes back to that. It's a big waste of time. So, you know, why would Krishna waste a devotee's time like that? One possible, you know, understanding that. No, so that's the way I see it, that all these great devotees, and there's been a lot of them now, you know. I mean, you got starting with Jayananda, then Mother Gauri, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and Sridhar Maharaj, and Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, and Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj, and Gaur Govinda Maharaj, and Sri Bhuvanath, and, you know, I'm sure I'm going to not name somebody. The list goes on, Nirguna, and et cetera. You know, there's been a lot of devotees, really good devotees, who've already left us, you know. But I think it is the explanation. They'd learned everything they needed to learn, and Krishna is just allowing them to move on. Of course, that's, you know, it's their, our loss, but their gain. But same time, Krishna's mercy is unlimited, so it's not, in one sense, it's not really our loss, because even though we're losing their association and their inspiration like that, still there's, Krishna will make sure there's plenty more, enough of that there. Just like, just want to give one analogy to further kind of illustrate that point. I know, I don't know if any of you play some sports. I used to be a bit interested in sports before I became a devotee, and in the sport called basketball. One thing they do in the professional games that, you know, say a team's playing and it's way ahead, you know, that like it's, you know, the team you're, the one team is way ahead, and it looks like there's no way the other team can win the game. So one of the first things the coach does is he pulls the star players before the end of the game. So, you know, he'll say, because he doesn't want to risk them getting injured in a game that's already won. You know what I mean? Everybody get the example there? He pulls them out with 5 minutes left or 2 minutes left or sometimes even more. He might even not even put them in if at last quarter or something like that. Because his thinking is, well, this game's already won. You know, why risk this person getting injured? So they pull him. And also, that's one reason why they do it. And also, it gives the crowd a chance to give them an ovation. You know, because they say they played a really good game. It gives all the, you know, the fans and everything a chance to, you know, give them a big cheer. Because if they just play right till the end of the game, they won't get any special recognition. So by pulling them out early, you know, he protects them from having anything go wrong. And he also gives everybody a chance to give them some special recognition. So that's the way I see the departure of all these great, great devotees who have already left us, you know. Krishna is just figures, hey, they've done it. They're there. They know everything. They've learned everything they need to learn. So they've been removed early in the game so that all of us can, you know, give them that special recognition and, you know, glorification on the occasions of their disappearance and, you know, just et cetera, and remember their lives and be inspired by their example. So that's my understanding of that, how that's working. Now, on another point here, Prabhupada in this purport, it's, you know, it's making the point a lot about how are we doing for time there? Okay, 10-2. Okay. He's making the point about how we're not this body. You know, that's kind of like a central theme in this purport, this text and purport, and some of the previous ones, and, you know, some of the verses coming up. It's dealing with this issue of how we are not this material body. So I just like to throw out at this point, you know, that actually, you know, some of you, if in case you're not already aware, it's not just like it's our scriptures who are saying this. In other words, don't just think that this is our trip, you know, that, oh, it's just the Hare Krishnas or have this understanding of that, you know, we're not this material body, we're internal spiritual beings. It's just their religious belief. No, it's more than that. It's a scientific fact. We are not these bodies. I'll just, to make it interesting, I'll just give you a few just examples of empiric evidence that support the idea that we are not these bodies. And, you know, as I said, probably you're familiar with this, but just to mention a few, okay? There's children who remember their past lives. And this is, there's been scientific studies conducted. There was this one man in America, he just passed away about 2 years ago. His name was Ian Stevenson. He was, he had all the, you know, credentials. He was a medical doctor. And he was practicing as a psychiatrist for many years in McGill, sorry, some university in Canada. Then he got transferred. He was the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Virginia. And he became introduced to this phenomena of young children. You know, this is something that goes on all over the world and it's been going on. Even Prabhupada mentions it in the Krishna book, Jati Smara. He says sometimes young children, when they first start to speak, remember who they were in their previous lifetime. So he became, that was brought to his attention, and he started investigating that phenomenon. Actually, he spent 30, 40 years of his career investigating that. He wrote about a dozen books. Two of them are like 2,000 pages thick, and they contain about 3,000 different case studies, which he, as a scientist, he's not a Hindu or a Buddhist, he has no hidden agenda there. He was just, as a scientist, he was investigating, what is the explanation for this? You know, these kids are coming up with these stories of a personality they were in the previous lifetime, and they're presenting all sorts of verifiable details. Now, just to give you an example, okay, some little girl in Bengal, she remembered who she was, that she belonged to this such and such family that lived like about 100 miles away. And when she was given the opportunity, she was able to lead a whole group of adults right to the place, you know, where she was born. And as they took her to the town by train. She got out of the train. She just started walking. They started following her. She walked right to where the house was that she formerly lived in. She showed them where her room was. She told them where all sorts of different things was. When she was in a group of 30 people, strangers, you know, at least for this lifetime, she was able to point out, oh, well, that's my former mother. That's my former father. She pointed out her daughter, you know, the little girl. And it wasn't just intellectual. She had all the appropriate emotions in relation to all these different people as well. And she pointed out a former husband and his two brothers and like that. And then that's just one case. There's so many like that. There's so many different amazing cases like that. And so that's one example. And another example is out-of-body experiences or what near-death experiences. And once again, I'll just give an example. This is something that happens when somebody is in a life-threatening situation. They've just been in a bad car crash and they're unconscious and they're taken to the hospital and they're going to operate on them, or they just had a heart attack, you know. So the circumstances leading into it is that the person is out, you know, knows, like when they put the monitors on them, you know, the EKG measuring their whatever that measures, the heart or the brain, the charts are flat. They're showing no either heart activity or no brain activity. Just the fact that the heart's not working means that no blood could go to the brain. That means, according to modern science, there's no way they could be conscious. Because as far as science is concerned, the mind or the ability to perceive anything is just a function of the brain. So if the brain doesn't work, there's no perception, according to the worldview of modern science. Okay, but here's what happens in a lot of these cases, okay? These people, they're being operated on, and then after the whole operation, okay, they're able to report everything, they're able to describe everything that happened. See, because what happens is they say, you know, it takes sometimes a little coaxing to get them to talk about it, because they're kind of like, they don't even understand it. They experienced it, but they don't understand it, and they know it's something that's not really socially acceptable, so they kind of feel a little bit, you know, reluctant or reticent to talk about it, because they don't want anybody to think they're crazy. But when they're encouraged to speak, you know, and they feel that it's kind of safe, which was done, this one doctor was a heart surgeon, and he did this with many, many patients. Then they start relating, well, see, what happened was all of a sudden I found myself at a point above my body. There was my body on the operating table, but I was someplace, I was like, you know, 6 or 8 feet or 10 feet above it, and I was just watching the whole thing. I could see everything. I could hear everything everybody could say. And the proof of that is that they're able to describe exactly what happened to them in that operation, you know, and the sequence of the different procedures, and what they were, and the correct sequence. They can even say, well, you know, this nurse said this at that time, and then the doctor said this, and, you know, all sorts of notes. They're able to present all sorts of verifiable details. And this happens time and time again. You know, as I said, there's one famous, the most probably famous thing, there's one doctor, his name was Michael Sabum. He wrote a book called A Medical Investigation of Death. And he was completely skeptical to start off with, but then when he kind of did his own investigations, he concluded that, yeah, these people, there's obviously something more to the mind, then it's just like a byproduct of the functioning of the brain. So that's another item of empiric evidence to support the idea that we are not this material body. We're something more than this material body. And then you have, I'll just mention these real quick just to throw them out there. You have people who have seen ghosts. I mean, you know, right down through the ages, people have seen ghosts. How do you know, what is that? How do you explain that? I mean, you could just say, oh, they're not just crazy. All sorts of responsible, respectable people in society have had that experience, and they report it. So that's another indication that was something more than just this material body. And then communications from departed spirits. That's also another item. But I'm just mentioning that just to make, general interest. But here's an interesting point, though. You might think that, okay, well, you know, if this is the case, I mean, it says so in the scriptures that we're not this body, and there seems to be like a whole lot of different empiric evidence to support it. Why is it that people still are so much out in left field? You know, why is it that the 99.99, I don't know how many 9% of the population is just totally in the bodily concept of life? Actually, it's even worse than what I just described. About 100 years ago, there was a group that formulated in England. It started off in Europe, and I think it was called the Society for Psychical Research. And the members of this organization were not just your average Tom, Dick, and Harrys. Some of these members were Nobel Prize winners in different scientific fields. Like one of them was Sir William Crookes. He was the inventor of the cathode ray tube television. Okay. Another one was Sir Alfred Russel Wallace, the co-founder of the theory of evolution along with Darwin. Another was Madame and Pierre Curie. They were the ones who pioneered X-ray, you know? And the list goes on. In other words, all sorts of prominent people in the fields, in all different sorts of scientific fields, were members of this group, Society for Psychical Research. William James in America, the father of modern psychology. Now, so they used to go to these seances, you know, and there would be like a medium there. Anyway, just to make the point clear, there was this one, in particular, there was one medium who was never found fraudulent. You know, his name was Daniel Dunglass Home. Just to give you an idea of, this is some of the stuff he did in broad daylight, witnessed by at different times, all these different personalities. He'd go into a trance, okay, and he'd levitate from where he was. He was lying on a bed. He'd levitate up. He'd go out the window, out an open window, and he'd be outside the building, you know, just floating in air. And then he'd travel about, 10, 15 feet and come back in the other window and then plunk down on the bed. And that was seen. That was observed by all these different personalities whose names I mentioned. On other occasions, they would take an accordion. He would be sitting at a table, and underneath the table, there would be like a cage, you know, and they put an accordion in the cage, and he would reach in with one hand, and he would hold the accordion, but not on the keyboard, but on the backside, you know, just put his hand through the strap there, and the accordion would start playing. And then at some point, he would take his hand out, and the accordion would be suspended in midair, playing. And this was witnessed by all these personalities. What else? He could make, I know this is hard to believe, but actually, if you want to learn more about this, if you find this hard to believe or too far, read Drew DeKarma's book, Human Devolution. And it's a really great book. It's kind of like the follow-up on his book, Forbidden Archaeology, Hidden History of the Human Race, and it describes all these things in his book. Actually, I'll tell you what, I'll leave it at that, because if I tell you some of the more stuff they did, I don't want to blow your mind, so to speak. But so this was all done, 100 years ago, and it was witnessed by top-level scientists. So somebody might ask, well, how is it possible? How is it possible that, you could even have somebody demonstrate it like that, and top people, leaders, could see that, and still, here we are 100 years later, and people, what to speak of, do they believe, believe in those kind of things? They're even more skeptical now than they were then. You think some progress might have been made, but just the opposite. It's kind of, people are more skeptical of those kind of things, those type of phenomena now than they were then. Well, the explanation is, everybody, it's Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga is progressing. Kali Yuga is progressing, and Prabhupada says in one poor port in the Gita that, the it's inconceivable how much, you know, the potency of the illusory energy is bewildering the living entities in the Kali Yuga. In other words, the conditioned souls in human bodies in the Kali Yuga, where they're a long way from home. Long way from home, right? And that's the explanation for, you know, despite the fact that here's the Krishna consciousness movement, we're preaching, you know, like anything, as you know, we're preaching as hard as we can. We're doing it, you know, I mean, there's always room for improvement. You know, we could always be doing more. We could be distributing more prasadam. We could be doing more kirtan. We could be distributing more books. Okay, yeah, I agree. But it's not like we've done nothing. I mean, you know, we've distributed a lot of books, right? And we've distributed a lot of prasadam. We've been out there. We've had a lot of exposure over the last, since 1965, you know, say 67, 40 years. Still, it's just like a drop in the bucket. You know, the vast human world is really basic, you know, well, unchanged to a greater or lesser degree. What was the other point I was going to make? Lost my train of thought there. Hang on, hopefully it's going to come back. Oh, yeah. There's that, and there's the empiric evidence that I just mentioned. These things are going on. But still, people are so much an illusion. So that can be understood that it's Kali Yuga progressing. So, so where do we come into the picture? Well, our response to that should be this, that, you know, we're fortunate. We've been delivered, you know, but by the mercy, you know, Brahmananda Brahmite Kona Bhagyavan Jeev, Guru Krishna Prashade by Bhakti Lata Beach. By the mercy of Krishna, one comes in contact with a bona fide spiritual master. And when one comes in contact with the bona fide spiritual master, he gets the message, the parampara, disciplic succession knowledge. And he gets the opportunity to engage in devotional service. And then by taking advantage of that opportunity, Guru Krishna Prashade by Bhakti Lata Beach, he comes, he gets Krishna. So we're very fortunate, whether we know it or not. Hopefully some of us are knowing it, experiencing it, and if you're not, take it from me, or take it from, you know, the Prabhupada and the books, that you're fortunate, that you're here and you're engaging in devotional service. We're fortunate. And our business is to try to, you know, very seriously and sincerely continue to try to engage in devotional service as we've learned it from His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada and the predecessor acharyas, and try to share it with other people. You know, we have to try to give it to other people. As difficult a task as that may seem to be, that's what we have to do. You know, nothing short of that. And it is difficult. It is difficult. And Prabhupada himself acknowledged how difficult it was. On one occasion he said, you know, we have to spare pounds of blood just to try to deliver one person. And just two other little examples he gave to, you know, illustrate this point about how difficult it was to preach in the you know, to make people Krishna consciousness in the Kali Yuga. Once he gave this example of, he said, trying to, you know, give people Krishna consciousness Kali Yuga is like trying to give medicine to a pig. I don't know if you, I never saw it, but I just heard Prabhupada talk about it. He explained that when you try to give a pig medicine, they're so stubborn. They're just so stubborn that even, you know, they're suffering like anything. When you try to give them the medicine, they do everything they can to resist. So in order to give a pig medicine, what they have to do is, Prabhupada described, he said, they have to have one person holding each of his front legs, one person holding each of his back legs, then they have another person opening his mouth, and then they even have another six, it requires seven people. Then they have another person with a blowgun, like, you know, a pea shooter, and they shoot the medicine down his throat. Because, see, if you just put it in the pig's mouth, he knows what it is, and he holds it and he spits it out. So they have to blowgun it down his throat, and then they have to have somebody tickle him on the throat. So that he kind of loses control a little bit, and he swallows it. It's hard like that. That's what it's like. You know, it's like feeding medicine, giving medicine to a pig. It's a real big project, you know. And that's, you know, Kali Yuga. And also, he made the statement that it's easy to wake up. You can wake up a man who's sleeping, but you can't wake up a man who's pretending to who's pretending to sleep. Probably everybody's heard that one, right? Yeah. So, you know, you can enlighten, you know, you can give spiritual knowledge to somebody who's kind of innocent and just doesn't want, but if people are so stubborn, deliberately they're trying to, you know, live in defiance or in rebellion to the will of God, which is really what's underlying this whole, you know, materialistic culture that is all pervading, you know, is pervading the whole world now, is in the process of, you know, spreading all over the world now. That's what's underneath it, you know, this a mentality to live in rebellion or in defiance to the will of God. I mean, just look at the things people are doing. It's just like they're doing exactly the things that are most displeasing to Krishna. Krishna's planet is called Goloka Vrindavan. Go means cows, and Loka means planet, the planet of the cows, right? So that's Krishna's favorite animal. So what are people eating? You know, what's the favorite food of people? Slaughtered animals, slaughtered cows. It's almost like it's in, you know, because there's so many different things to eat. Why do human beings have to kill cows to eat cow flesh? There's like, there's such a wide variety of different foodstuffs people can maintain their body on. It's, as I said, it could almost be seen as a deliberate act of defiance and rebellion. Anyway, the list goes on. But still, we have to try. That's, you know, Lord Chaitanya said, yare deke tare kaha Krishna upadesh. Wherever you go, whoever you meet, tell them about Krishna. That's the order. And actually, and elsewhere in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Lord Chaitanya said, I order every man within this universe to accept this Krishna consciousness movement and try to spread it. So that's what Lord Chaitanya said 500 years ago. And of course, and Krishna said that 5,000 years ago. And that's the same instruction that we received from our spiritual masters, you know, Srila Prabhupada and our current spiritual masters. We have to try to preach. And the conclusion is that was one, another expression in American. It goes, they say, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Right? Everybody's heard that expression? You can lead a horse to water, but you can't force him to drink. That's true. You can't. You know? But that doesn't mean you have to stop leading him. You just got to keep leading him. Even though that stubborn horse is thirsty like anything, you know, and you're leading him right to the water and he might not drink, you can't give up. You know, you just got to lead him there the next day. And you got to lead him there the next day. And you got to just keep leading them there. Maybe one of these days he'll drink. You know, in any event, just imagine you have a job as you're a caretaker of the horses. If you're just doing your thing of leading the horses to water all the time, even though they don't drink, you know, the person you're working for could see, well, this guy's doing his job. He's happy with you. You still get paid. So in the same way, you know, we should never get discouraged, even if, you know, people aren't taking to Krishna consciousness as we'd ideally like to see them taking to it. Still, we shouldn't get discouraged. Krishna's pleased with our efforts. Just like the person who's, you know, the boss of the guy who's taking care of the horses, he could see this guy. Well, this horse trainer is trying. He's leading these horses to the water. They're just not drinking. What can the poor guy do? So in the same way, you know, we just have to keep trying, keep presenting, keep trying to make every effort to attract the fallen conditioned souls to become interested and engage in devotional service. And simply by doing that, our lives are successful. Prabhupada once told one devotee, he said, the endeavor is the perfection. So just by trying like that, trying ourselves to be, you know, sincere and serious devotees and trying to, with the same sincerity and the same seriousness, trying to share it with other people, we're in good shape. You know, we're pleasing our spiritual masters and predecessor acharyas. Okay, so I'll stop there. Hopefully it's about 10 past, and hopefully we've got a few questions, or we have 5 minutes left. Anybody have any question or comment about any of these points? Prabhu?
Hare Krishna. Thank you very much, Prabhu. At the end of your class, you mentioned about leading horses to water and them not drinking, and if we keep leading and they're not drinking, that's still success. Sometimes we may experience in preaching, we spend a lot of time on certain people really trying to get them to drink, and they don't drink, and we think sometimes many horses are going by and we're not giving them the opportunity to drink. So just wondering if practically you have some advice for how much time we should spend on someone who maybe isn't drinking, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I don't think you could make a hard and fast rule. You know, tesham satadiyuktanam bhajatam pratipurvakam. To those who are constantly devoted and worship with love, Krishna says, I give them the intelligence by which they can come to me. Just let Super Soul be your guide. You know, in every different situation, you'll know Krishna's within your heart, and he's going to be telling you. okay, that's enough for this person, you know, they're not getting anywhere, just move on. He's had enough opportunity. Give somebody else a chance. Or Krishna might just be, you know, he might tell you this person just needs a little bit more. Just give him a bit more, and they just might be ready to, you know, say, okay, and let me have that book. And I've had that happen, you know. I've had people where I just thought, you know, at first they might say no 3 times, and I just decided, well, I'm just going to give this person one more little push. I'll just, you know, just defeat one more excuse and give them one more reason why they should take the book or whatever. And then, to my surprise, they go, well, okay. And they just say, how much is it? It's $20, okay. And boom, they give it, you know, they give a nice donation. But as I said, you just have to let the super soul be your guide. He's in there. He'll inspire you what the right thing is to do. Anybody else? I'll give one more example. You have a chance to think for a second. I'll give one more example of how difficult it is. Before I became a devotee, I didn't have many jobs, maybe like a dozen. And I didn't last long at any of them. But one job I did have, it was one of my first jobs, is I was a male nurse's aide in a hospital. You know, I used to help the male nurse. And some of the things I had to do, among the things I had to do was I had to, you know, shave the people to get them ready for their operations. And I had to, after people passed away, I had to take them down to the morgue downstairs. I could tell a funny story about that if I have time. But one of the things I had to do is I had to get the people in and out of the bed and in and out of the chairs. Because, you know, a lot of these people were old people. And the situation was that, you know, they'd be lying in bed for hours on end. And if you've never experienced this yourself, you know, you can't. Even you might have the idea in your head, oh, wouldn't it be nice if I could just lie in bed and all day? Well, it isn't. If you ever try it, you can't. You can only stay in that position for, you know, for so long, and then it's really uncomfortable. So what happened. These people used to be like lying in bed for X amount of time, and when they started getting really uncomfortable, they couldn't get out themselves. You know, they would ring, they would press a little button, and a light would go on, and a buzzer would go off, and I'd have to come and get them out of the bed and put them into the chair, or vice versa, or get them out of the chair and put them back into bed. And, you know, I always remember this, like it's an analogy of preaching, you know, what it's like dealing with conditioned souls in the Kali Yuga. What always used to happen was this. At that time, I was about 18 years old, and I probably was about like twice the size of what I am now. I was actually like, believe it or not, I used to be a little bit athletic and kind of stronger. So there was no question that I couldn't do it, you know. So I used to go up to them, and I'd say, okay. I said, look, I put my arms underneath their, you know, underneath their arms like that, and I grab them from the back, and I tell them, okay, look, just relax, you know, because, you know, and I'll have you out of, within 30 seconds, I'll have you out of this bed and into the chair. But invariably, what would happen was when I started lifting them up, they would grab onto the rails. You know, they would grab onto the side rails on the bed, or if they were in the chair, they would grab onto the armrests, you know. And, you know, I couldn't do it, you know. I'd be pulling them, and they'd be, you know. But I found it was so ironic, because on the one hand, they would go, oh, get me out of this bed, or, oh, you know, they'd be moaning, get me out of this chair. And then when I'd go to pull them out, you know, then they would hang on for dear life. We used to have to get the actual male nurse used to have to come and pry their hands open. And then I would like, so it's like the conditioned souls, you know, on the one hand, people are, you know, suffering and they know it and they, you know, they want help. But then when we come to help them, they give us so much resistance. They're so kind of, you know, unwilling like that. But once again, we have to persevere. And as I think I read it in the other day in a class a couple mornings ago, there's this one purport in the fourth canto where Prabhupada talks about how the pure devotee, he's always thinking about how to deliver the conditioned souls. And he's always making plans how to do that. And then Prabhupada goes on to say, so the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I can't remember exact words, but the gist of it was that Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he can understand that his pure devotee is desiring in this way and endeavoring in this way to show mercy to these fallen conditioned souls. So then it says that Krishna, reciprocating with the pure devotee, by his causeless mercy, enlightens the general populace from within. See, so that's how it works. You know, if we just keep trying, you know, then you know, the impossible will become possible. Nothing's impossible for Krishna. If we just keep trying, like Prabhupada, he just kept trying, and then at some point Krishna just decided, wow, you know what? Even though these people are just so unqualified to get the opportunity to engage in devotional service, here's my pure devotee. He's so sincere. He's trying so hard. Okay, so some of these fools and idiots are going to just have to get the, I'm going to enlighten them enough, and they're going to have to get an opportunity, because I'm not going to see my pure devotee disappointed. You know, he's so determined. He's desiring so intensely to have a Krishna conscious movement. I got to give him a Krishna conscious movement. That means some of these, you know, yo-yos are going to have to become devotees. Like that. So in the same way, if we have to just follow in Prabhupada's footsteps, be very, very sincere and serious and determined, and Krishna will take compassion upon us. You know, he'll want to reciprocate with us, and he will, as it says in that purport, he'll enlighten the general populace, and those people will just become inspired, and they'll want to engage in devotional service, and in that way, the movement will spread, despite their material disqualifications. Okay, anybody, anything else? I told it. That was that story about, you know, with the... What? You want to hear that story? Okay. I don't know how much it has to do with Krishna concept, but I'll tell you real quick. So, as I said, one of the things I had to do was I had to take the people after they passed away down to the morgue, which was like, you know, it was in the bottom of the hospital. And And I was, as I said, I was just about 18 years old. I was kind of pretty young. So I went down there. The male nurse and I went down there. We had the person on the stretcher, and we put the person on the table because, you know, they do certain things to the body to get it ready for the funeral and everything. A lot of times they'll do that down there. So we put the person, we moved him from the bed onto this stainless steel table, and we had to wash him and dress him again. So he said, okay, Jeff, that was my name before I was in. She said, you wait here, you know, and I'm going to get the clothes and I'll be right back. You know, so he leaves, he goes out, closes the door, and he goes into the next room. And so I'm there, and, you know, the body's there on the table there. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm just standing there, and all of a sudden I hear, and I go, whoa, what's this, you know? So I run to the door, you know, to try to, I said, I got to get out of here. You know, I run to the door and try to open. I couldn't open the door, you know. And then I hear it again. I didn't know what it was. I thought, uh-oh, is this dead person coming back to life? Or what's going on here, you know. So the nurse's name was Jose. So I cried out, Jose, you know. And so he heard me yelling. He came back into the room, and when he saw how scared I was, he started laughing. And you know, he said, "What's up? I said, "This is his dead body." Anyway, what was happening was that it's rigor mortis. In other words, when the person dies, there's a certain amount of air that's caught in their within their stomach, and. And when they, you know, after they're dead for a while, the rigor mortis sets in, something happens with the muscle. So it was actually, what was happening was that air was being squeezed out of the stomach. And as it was coming out, it was making a noise. It was vibrating. But I didn't know that. So I thought it was my first supernatural experience of my life. But anyway, so that's that story. Okay, thank you very much. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.